This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take an in-depth look at President Trump's Election Integrity Commission.
If there ever was an Orwellian formulation, it's this one. This Election Integrity Commission has no intention of preserving the integrity of elections.
We'll look at the acceleration of growth of the right and talk to a young activist who has some wonderful ideas about how to counter it.
Trump's election both reflected and accelerated the growth of a neo-fascist movement in this country. What do we do about it? Give a listen.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Donald Trump lost last November's election by some 3 million of the popular vote. Subsequently, he falsely asserted that between 3 and 5 million votes were cast illegally. Then, in May of this year, by executive order, Trump established the Election Integrity Commission. The nominal head of the commission is Vice President Mike Pence, but the functioning head is Chris Korbach, the Kansas Secretary of State, who has a long history of successful voter suppression. He is running for governor on this record. Korbach was recently fined by a federal magistrate for, quote, making patently misleading representations to the court and abusing the judicial process when he lied to the judge about the content of certain papers that he shared with Trump concerning voter suppression. Korbach is helping Trump lay the groundwork for a national voter suppression effort. His commission wrote to the 50 secretaries of state in the U.S. asking for private information on the voters in their states. 44 of the 50 secretaries of state have told Korbach that they will give him little or no information. A leading resister, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, said, quote, at best this committee was set up as a pretext to validate Donald Trump's alternative election facts. And at worst, it is a tool to commit large-scale voter suppression. Joining us to talk about this is Eliza Carney, senior editor at American Prospect, who's been covering this story. Eliza, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the origin of President Trump's Election Integrity Commission?
The commission's origin is the president's conviction that the election was fraudulently stolen from him. The popular vote was stolen from him. He's made the unsubstantiated claim that 3 to 5 million Americans voted illegally in the last election, which just has absolutely no evidence to back it up. And he created this commission by executive order in May.
And who serves on the commission?
Well, the commission has taken a lot of heat because it differs from past presidential election commissions in that it is not headed by a Republican and a Democrat. It's headed by two Republicans. The official head is Vice President Mike Pence, but the vice chairman, who is perceived to be actually running the show, is the Kansas Secretary of State, Chris Korbach, who has been repeatedly sued for his efforts in Kansas to require people to show evidence of citizenship just to register to vote. And he's perceived as one of the leading sort of vote suppression, if you will, advocates in the United States. There are other conservatives on the commission who have been lightning rods of criticism, all of them leading conservative proponents of voter fraud theories that haven't been substantiated, including Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation and various other conservative secretaries of state and scholars who have been widely criticized by voting rights advocates for their views.
Governor Terry McAuliffe of Virginia said he had no intention of honoring the Election Integrity Commission request for information on his citizens. He said, quote, this entire commission is based on the specious and false notion that there is widespread voter fraud last November. Can you talk about that notion that there's voter fraud last November and that voter fraud generally is a problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's been extensive research done upon this, and there was a seminal study by the Brennan Center for Justice in New York a few years back that basically concluded that you know, while there are certainly a few cases nationally of voter fraud, the notion that it's widespread is just not substantiated. What there is frequently is problems with the voter rolls. There are a lot of examples of people on the rolls who shouldn't be there, people who have moved and didn't notify the Secretary of State, people who are registered in more than one state, people who are deceased and are still on the rolls. But there isn't actually any evidence that this translates into widespread fraud at the polls. You do find some cases, but given the number of people who vote every year, it's just an infinitesimal fraction. But the interesting thing about McAuliffe is that he's one of quite maybe more than three dozen secretaries of state and election officials around the country who have said they will not comply with this request. And this includes a lot of Republicans as well, people in Mississippi and other red states who have been quite vociferous that not only is this not necessarily a good premise upon which to begin, but that the request for a lot of personal voter data goes against state laws and also could lead to a lot of false positives in the sense that if you have limited data, unless you're very careful with the data, you can come up with a lot of supposed double registries which actually involve different people because a lot of people share the same birth date and name in this country. Millions of people, in fact. So that's
been a problem for me my whole life.
Accurate cross-check. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Eliza, do you think that the real purpose of the commission is to impose new national restrictions on voters?
Well, there's certainly that perception out there in the voting rights community, and Chris Kobach, the vice chair, is on record essentially saying that one of the reasons they want this data is to cross-check state voter rolls with federal databases that identify illegal immigrants. And there's a lot of alarm, frankly, in the voting rights community that the upshot or the outcome of all this, you know, could be to try to purge voter rolls. There are already some conservative and Republican-controlled states that have done controversial purges of voter rolls in which eligible voters have been kicked off. And there's a lot of fear that that's the ultimate goal of this commission. The commission has not said that at all. They state that they're going into this with an open mind, that they're interested in finding the facts. You know, so it would be unfair to jump to conclusions, but I will say there's a lot of anxiety in the voting and civil rights community about this commission. And the commission itself is perceived as a serious threat to voting rights.
We heard a rumor that Chris Kobach had gotten fined by a federal magistrate. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes. I did a story about that for the American Prospect. He was fined $1,000 for, quote, deceptive conduct and lack of candor, which was really quite extraordinary. The judge was pretty plain speaking in his statement that Kobach had essentially lied to a federal court. And this goes back to the ACLU's lawsuit against Kobach in Kansas involving his efforts to cross-check Kansas voter or to require Kansas registrants to show proof of citizenship, which the ACLU says is unconstitutional. There was a strange series of events whereby Kobach was photographed by the AP walking into a meeting with President Trump. This was during last year's campaign. And the documents that he held were plain to see in the photo. And they essentially said, you know, in part, you could divine what the document said, proposals to change the National Voter Registration Act. And so the AP said, we need to have discovery of these documents. And the court asked Kobach about it, and Kobach essentially said these documents have nothing to do with the case and they have nothing to do with changing, you know, the National Voter Registration Act. So the court said, well, we'd like to see the documents. The documents have not been publicly released, but the federal judge in question saw the documents and concluded that, yes, they were quite relevant and that Kobach had misled the court and that that was contrary to federal law. So it was really quite an extraordinary example of mendacity being punished. So,
Eliza, in an unprecedented effort to comb and pull together a vast amount of data on 200 million registered voters in our country, Chris Korbach wrote the secretaries of all 50 states asking for information on their voters, including their first and last names, date of birth, political party affiliation, address, last four digits, their Social Security number, their voting history since 2006, felony convictions, voter registration in another state, military status, and overseas citizen information. What happened to this request that Korbach made?
Well, he now faces, I believe, seven lawsuits around this request. There are multiple laws that he's alleged to have violated, or the commission's alleged to have violated, in releasing this request. There are federal laws that govern how presidential commissions must operate. They need to operate with transparency and in public. There was no public meeting preceding this request, so he faces lawsuits on that score. There's a privacy group that claims that this violates the Privacy Act because there need to be protocols that the government goes through when it collects private data of this nature, and there was no there was no pre-evaluation to explain how they were going to protect the information. So those are just a couple of suits that are out there. And as I said, it's not just Democrats in the states that have been concerned about it. It's Republicans as well. One of the problems now is that the information that the states are going to send to the commission is fairly limited. The commission just isn't going to get from every state the last four digits of the Social Security number and the felony convictions, et cetera. And so they're going to end up with a database which is basically pretty limited. The danger here is that you can't accurately cross-check voter records with federal records when you have such limited information. The irony is that 20 states and the District of Columbia already participate in a nonprofit consortium called ERIC, the Electronic Information Record System, that allows states to share voter data with privacy protocols in place, with anonymity, and with a high level of accuracy. And there are a lot of election officials and election experts that have wondered, who have wondered, why didn't the commission just go to ERIC as their starting point? So that's kind of a mystery. And in fact, one Republican state official actually wrote to Korbach and said, you know, you should really reach out to ERIC and figure out what they're doing. And by the way you're doing this isn't going to yield accurate results.
Really? That's interesting.
So have they withdrawn that request to all 50?
Yes, they have done that because of the privacy lawsuit that they face, which asks for a temporary restraining order. I think in order to sort of strengthen their hand in dealing with the federal judge in that case, they temporarily halted their request to the states. They said, let's put this request on hold. I think they did that in an effort to protect themselves from being subject to this restraining order and to strengthen their hand in that dispute. So we'll see where it goes. They obviously have every intent to go back and continue asking the states for information, but right now that is on hold.
So would you characterize this as at least a temporary victory?
Yeah, the civil rights community definitely characterizes it as a victory. Yeah, give credit where credit is due to those who stepped in to take action here.
Eliza, a number of Republican states have harsh restrictions on registration and voting. Hillary Shelton, the Washington director of the NAACP, has said that GOP state legislatures have long used the specter of voter fraud as justification to enact voter ID laws. Are restrictions used on poor individuals and persons of color primarily in those who vote Democratic?
A lot of the restrictions that exist are thought to hit Democratic voters more hard, not only persons of color, but students, the elderly. The kinds of information that people ask for in these voter ID requirements are birth certificates, driver's licenses. Not everybody in the United States has that stuff. The statement is constantly made, well, you know, you need a driver's license to rent a car or rent a video. People don't really rent videos anymore, but that's the kind of example people hold out. But in point of fact, you know, renting a car or a video is not a constitutional right, and voting is. So even if one person is unable to register to vote or to vote because they don't have their birth certificate, that's a violation of civil rights. So these are very legitimate concerns that are upheld.
Eliza, I'm interested in this request they made for felony convictions, because I know from the history, as a reaction to the Civil War, when black people had won the right to vote, new laws were passed excluding them from voting if they had any felony convictions. And a lot of black people were arrested and convicted of felonies, even when they were innocent, and then they couldn't vote. And that condition exists even till today, when there are millions of people that can't vote because of felony convictions. And I wanted to ask you about that. How extensive is that suppression?
I think that it's fair to say that there are probably hundreds of thousands of convicted felons who are not able to vote in this country, if not millions. And it's a major battle in the civil and voting rights community to try to convince states to reverse these restrictions on convicted felons once they've served their terms. And there are some states that have come out and said that felons should be able to vote, but it's contested and it continues to be a major battle.
Eliza, is there concern that the production of all this data on voters could be used somehow by cyber hackers?
Yes, I think there's a substantial irony here. The states are less worried about voter fraud than they are about cybersecurity. As we know, recent disclosures have made clear that Russian actors tried to hack into as many 21 state election databases in the last election, which has really caused a lot of concern among state election officials. And the Department of Homeland Security has been working with states to try to ensure better security. The irony here is that this so-called Election Integrity Commission is now creating a central repository of information, which would actually make us more vulnerable to Russian hackers, because the one thing that saved us in the last election is we have a decentralized system. We have 10,000 voting places administered separately all over the country. So there's no central database of American voters. But by collecting all this information, the Integrity Commission is essentially extending an open invitation to bad actors, whether they're identity thieves or foreign interests. Come on in. You know, it's all here in one place for you now. I mean, it's really ironic.
Is there any way for us to judge just how many voters have been suppressed, not allowed to vote in recent times?
That is not something that has been studied on a national scale. Every now and then, someone zeroes in on a particular state or a particular county and tries to conclude whether because of long lines or because of IDs or for other reasons, you know, thousands of people have been disenfranchised. You know, there are different estimates and different scenarios. I mean, certainly tens of thousands are the estimates that have been put out, you know, in various scenarios. But I don't believe there's an overall number. You know, that's one of the things that we're just lacking in our analysis of voting in the U.S.
Eliza, we just have a few minutes remaining. We wanted to ask if you think that the Trump Commission lacks credibility because it was established by executive order. It's not bipartisan, and Korbach is using his position in his gubernatorial race.
I don't think that the simple fact of an executive order is what's controversial, but certainly the fact that it is run by two Republicans instead of by a Republican and a Democrat has undermined its credibility. The fact that there are so many conservatives who are sort of proponents of voter fraud theories on the commission has undermined its credibility. The way in which the commission got started, operating without public meeting before taking its first action, issuing this apparently not very well thought out request to the states, all of those things have damaged its credibility. Now, I've talked to election experts who essentially say this commission cannot be salvaged. And in fact, there's been some speculation that really the solution here is going to have to be found by non-government actors, or at least by state actors. Really, state election officials are very diligent. They're working very hard. They're trying to walk a difficult line between taking concerns seriously while also reassuring voters that hacking didn't disrupt the last election and that, in fact, their voter information is safe. There are new groups that are being set up in the academic sphere to examine cybersecurity, including one recently announced up at Harvard. So, you know, this commission probably isn't going to be where people look for serious answers to the questions around voting in the United States.
The commission met on July 19th. Do we know what came out of that meeting?
Yes, I actually watched that meeting. It was not open to the public, but it was streamed. There were a lot of statements about how nonpartisan and open the commission was, which to me was a bit surreal, and I wrote about this in the Prospect today. There were all these statements about how the commission was going in with an open mind, that it hadn't reached its conclusions yet, and yet so much of the debate during the discussion was about voter fraud and how much of a concern it can and should be, and there were also suggestions made by some of the commissioners that they should ask for even more information from the states, that they should go ask states, you know, what federal databases are you cross-checking when you verify registrations? Are you looking at, you know, records that show that people are in the country illegally or have been detained by the federal government? And if so, you know, have you notified the Justice Department so we can prosecute these people? I mean, if I were a civil rights advocate, I would imagine that the civil rights community and the voting rights community looked at that first meeting and just became more alarmed than ever, you know, about the direction that this commission is taking.
I think on even a broader scale, just the very fact that they have this Orwellian-named commission would tend to undermine American citizens' faith in the integrity of the election process, because they have a commission that's looking into it. So the assumption is that there's something wrong.
Right.
Do you think that has going to have an effect?
Well, I think that's the irony here, is that the, you know, commissioner sort of bemoaned that Americans don't have faith in our elections, and yet the president came in and spoke at the beginning with a welcome that included some of his most sort of damning statements ever about the integrity of the election and how, you know, he kept running into people on the campaign trail who had concerns about large numbers of fraudulent votes. So the president himself is contributing to lack of faith in the system. And there are, in fact, voters who have deregistered. Thousands of voters have deregistered in Colorado and elsewhere because now they're afraid the federal government's going to grab their personal information. So that's really disturbing. And frankly, the whole thing just makes the job of state and local election officials harder than it already is.
The assertion that Obama is a Muslim non-citizen is in the same league with this assertion that all these people are fraudulently voting. Eliza, how can our listeners follow your work on this story?
Yeah, well, there are two ways. One is to go to prospect.com, and, you know, all of my material is on there, the American Prospect. The other is to follow me on Twitter. And my Twitter handle is @ElizaRules. My column is the Democracy Rules column. So @ElizaRules is my Twitter handle.
That's fabulous. Well, you rule for us, Eliza. It's been really fascinating spending some time with you. And we hope to have you on again as things progress in this arena.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The election of Donald Trump has greatly emboldened the forces on the right. We have seen lynchings, stabbings, and even murder. The acquittal of murderous cops is almost routine. Deportations number in the tens of thousands. A number of left-wing professors have been suppressed. Right-wing provocateurs and racist speakers have appeared on campuses. Fascists have attempted to organize rallies in major cities. Hardcore groups like the Klan and racist skinheads and outright fascist organizations like Richard Spencer's National Policy Institute have been growing. So have militia organizations. The Republican Party, the Congressional Freedom Caucus, fundamentalists, Fox News aficionados and neocons have also seen their strength in numbers and influence increase. How do we fight this? Should we ask the government for help? Should we confront the right? Do we need a mass movement? Do we have to present a political alternative to provide real answers to real problems? Our guest today is Chicago activist John Kerensky. He recently gave a speech on the topic of fighting the right at the Socialism 2017 conference in Chicago, which had a record attendance of over 2,000 people.
John Kerensky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
John, how has Donald Trump's election accelerated the growth of the right?
So the individuals and groups that are operating under the name of the alt-right are really nothing new in this country, though perhaps the term is new. They've been growing at an increasing rate for some time. So I think Trump's campaign helped serve up an audience of potential new recruits to far-right organizations, as his profile reaches much farther than what you might call the handshake reach of the existing far-right groups. His strongman style on the campaign trail helped inspire other lesser orators, like Yiannopoulos, and the campaign events themselves helped give some unity to forces on the right in the form of a perceived common leader and project. And of course, Trump's victory was seen as unlikely by much of the media. It tended to legitimize the idea that the prior leaders of both the Democratic and Republican parties are out of touch with the needs and desires of most people, which is a really important idea for the far right as it is for the left. So that's kind of how Trump's campaign itself helped the right. But it's also important that Trump and the growth of the far right are, in turn, both products of something deeper. And I'm, of course, talking about the fact that we're 8 years into a global economic slump following the 2008 crash. Corporate profits have made a significant recovery, but wages haven't recovered, and productivity growth was negative last year, meaning working class and middle class people are getting hit really hard. You know, the opioid crisis, you could see, is another symptom of this. So how does that lead to the growth of the right? Well, there's a crisis of legitimacy for the mainstream parties, and people are looking for alternatives. In the absence of a strong left and a fighting labor movement, the right can profit.
I have in front of me a wonderful diagram of a rotten onion. And you have compared the far right to the layers of a rotten onion. That is to say, there's an inner core, which rots first, then spreads to the middle layers, and finally the outer layers. I'd like to go through each layer. Who would you
yes.
place at the inner core?
Yes, the onion. Since coming up with this metaphor, I realized that onions actually rot from the outside, so that tells you something about how much I know about cooking. But the inner core, yes. So the inner core we'd characterize as including groups like the Klan, racist skinheads, those are some of the older organizations, as well as some new organizations with a growing profile, like Matthew Heimbach's Traditionalist Workers' Party and Richard Spencer's National Policy Institute. So the inner core are groups that are fascists in virtue of both their deeds and their program. Therefore, homogenous ethno-religious communities for getting there through a revolutionary overthrow or takeover of the state, sometimes including secession from the United States. But very importantly, they see the organized left and the labor movement as among their main enemies, and if possible, they'd like to use force to wipe us out. So the inner core are people who are fascists in virtue of their deeds and their program.
Hmm. And the middle layer, who is in that?
And so the middle layer are people who we would describe as fascists by virtue of deeds, but not necessarily their ideology. So they haven't yet drawn all the political conclusions that are shared by the inner core, but they're committed to an orientation on street fighting that postures as self-defense. And so right now this layer includes some older militia organizations, the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers, mostly started by people who are ex-military officers or ex-law enforcement, as well as some newer groups like Gavin McInnes' Proud Boys, a street fighting organization, and another group that exists within it called the Fraternal Order of the Alt Knights, which has recently gotten a pretty large following on the internet.
Now, just for a second, when you say street fighting, such as the Proud Boys, do you literally mean they provoke violence in the streets?
Quite often, yes. Often they try and frame their violence as self-defense. And so they'll say, you know, the left or the coastal elites or liberals want to take away our rights. And then they'll come out to a demonstration armed in order to defend, what they perceive to be attacks on their rights. But there are also many documented cases of these organizations actively provoking violence in a way that can't really be painted in any by any reasonable person as self-defense.
Right. Okay, got it. Now, the outer layers, you say, include the Republican Party, and who else?
So I guess, you know, the Congressional Freedom Caucus, some religious fundamentalists, many people who describe themselves as libertarians, Fox News aficionados, neocons. It's a pretty broad group of people. And so, you know, it's quite diverse. Some people in the outer layer have a lot of political power and some do not. What's common to this group, for the purposes of our metaphor, is simply that they're all people whom the inner and middle layers would like to try and influence and recruit. So the metaphor isn't trying to say, like, the people in the inner layer are actually pulling the strings of the Republican Party. It's not some kind of Glenn Beck chalkboard conspiracy theory. Most of the powerful people, in fact, do inhabit the outer layer. While some have connections to and sympathy with the inner layer, many and most in the outer layer see the inner and middle layers as subscribing to an extreme ideology which they don't share. And so, given this, and this is kind of the point of the metaphor to help us understand this, what's the inner layer's strategy to overcome their isolation? To what extent is that working, and how can we stop it? And we think that strategy will change over time, but right now, I think the strategy is to paint the outer layer, and especially middle and working class people, white people in the outer layer, as a victimized minority of left-wing and liberal aggression, and to present themselves as salvation against that aggression. And the middle layer plays this a very particular role in this. Through attempting to disavow explicit fascist ideology, it gets around the aversion to the inner layer, but then tries to legitimize violent street-fighting tactics, which I would describe as fascist tactics, as a way forward for people in the outer layer to draw them towards the center. And that's very relevant for strategic discussions for us on the left.
John, I want to ask you to elaborate a bit. When you reference liberal aggression, what are you talking about?
So I think that many people, and this is part of the political context created by Trump, they see the leaders of the two mainstream parties as having lost touch with a vast majority of people in society. And there's a tendency to, especially in some rural areas, to say, you know, the reason why we've got to the situation we're at is because of, you know, college professors or coastal elites or the people who run, you know, MSNBC or CNN. And right-wing populists have tried to play into this. And so the left can sometimes do things that, you know, that play into this perception. And we'll get into this, I think, a bit later, but that especially can happen when the left calls to take away the free speech rights of people who are in the inner and outer layers.
What happened at Middlebury College when students stopped the racist scholar Charles Murray from speaking?
Sure, yes. So this is a complex issue. I think students make a ton of mistakes in their activism as they're new to getting involved in fighting the right. And I think the liberal press is kind of has been chomping at the bit to point out those mistakes, sometimes unaware of the complexities. And so, in general, in the schema of this metaphor, you know, Murray, whose ideas are pretty reprehensible, is an outer layer scholar, as he doesn't really advocate or organize street fighting tactics yet. And so, you know, I think that means he ought to be debated, and his ideas ought to be defeated through tactics of debate. Many students at Middlebury understood this and tried to campaign to get themselves, a seat on the stage alongside Murray, so that other ideas would be presented to an audience in addition to his. But they didn't succeed in getting this to happen, and so they brought signs and yelled during the event in order to challenge him from the floor. Eventually, this culminated in the event being shut down. And then outside, after the event, and I would put this in something of a different category from the protests that happened on the inside, some people decided to attack a school official and to try and physically assault Charles Murray. Now, of course, what happened afterward got all the attention in the media, and the debates beforehand about the right way to try and create a debate with Murray didn't get a ton of attention. So that, meaning despite, I think, some pretty good organizing on the part of many people involved in this, the episode on the whole played the role of an attack on someone who is perceived by many in the outer layer to be kind of one of us that helped drive people in the outer layer into the arms of the inner layer.
Yeah, exactly, because Charles Murray wrote a book 20 years ago or so called The Bell Curve, and he attempted to defend the proposition that black people are inferior. And the great Harvard scholar Stephen Jay Gould wrote a book called The Mismeasure of Man, where he countered Murray's theories and blew him away. I think the students at Middlebury College were the ones that wanted to debate this question, knew they could prevail in a rational debate. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me very unfortunate the way the whole thing played out.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about the Ku Klux Klan.
They
tried to have a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Talk to us about that. What happened?
Yeah, so this, I think, is an example of a brilliant success for our side. So 2 weeks ago, some 50 Klan members tried to hold a rally in front of a statue of Robert E. Lee, and they were met with over 1,000 counter-protesters, a very diverse coalition of various left organizations, people involved in social movements such as Black Lives Matter, and some members of trade unions. And so, you know, some people in the counter-protest decided to try and take over the spot where the Klan was rallying, and fortunately there weren't enough of them to overcome resistance from the police, who, as they often do, defended the Klan. So the police tear-gassed and arrested a number of people from the rally, I think somewhere around 20, and our side didn't succeed in completely shutting down the Klan rally, and of course we're going to have to organize to defend the people who were attacked and arrested. But, you know, I think that hardly means it was a failed event. In fact, it's a brilliant example of a demonstration that shows that the vast majority of people aren't actually in favor of the Klan's racism. And this is very important because the way in which the inner layer, which includes groups like the Klan, tries to appeal to the outer layer is based on, you know, trying to say that that actually the majority of white people or of people in general are sympathetic to racism or to fascist ideas, but just aren't willing to say so because of political correctness. And so, you know, when we are able to bring thousands of people out with us to confront the right, it helps send the message that makes it that the majority of people are opposed to what the inner layer says, and makes it very difficult for the inner layer to maintain its narrative, according to which fascists are actually a persecuted minority that's just afraid to speak out.
John, what happened in Portland, Oregon, when members of the right attempted a rally?
Yes, this is another great example. So, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, there was someone who was associated with the far right who had gone to some rallies, stabbed two people on a train in Portland just about a month ago. And in response to this, you know, the whole city was on edge. The right had already planned to have a rally that was billed as a free speech rally. And the left had begun to organize a response when the stabbing occurred. And the stabbing created a set of circumstances where it was possible for our side to mobilize much larger numbers. So the mayor called for the left to cancel its rally, to ignore the far right, you're only giving them attention, that kind of thing. And in response to this, thousands of people came out to a rally organized by a coalition. And the coalition called itself Portland United Against Hate. And this coalition argued that we needed a nonviolent response to the far right's, so-called free speech rally. And they argued for this because many of the confrontations with the far right in Portland in the months prior had kind of had dwindling numbers because of the violence that took place. And so they said, we have to reopen a space for nonviolent resistance to the far right in contrast to the violence that the far right had recently, you know, exhibited in the case of the stabbing. And this really seemed to resonate. And thousands, you know, I think about 1,500 people came out to a demonstration. And again, this was, you know, a case of our side beginning to show that the majority are opposed to the far right's ideas, which makes it much harder for them to go back home and recruit and to build their own ranks.
You've written about four principles on how to fight the right. John, you indicated that the state won't do it for us. Why do you believe that asking the state to do it for us is a disaster for our side? And I know that a person that both of us admire, Hal Draper, has written about that. So I wanted to ask you initially about why do you think the state won't do it for us, and then talk a bit about Hal Draper's thoughts.
Great, yes. So, yeah, we had talked about four principles in the presentation for fighting the right. One of them was the state shouldn't do it for us. The second was you have to actually confront them. You know, it does no good to have a rally 5 miles away from where the far right is marching. The third is you have to build a mass movement. So, you know, you've got to really try and do your best to outnumber the far right by a pretty big factor. And the last one is that you have to present a political alternative. I mean, we can maybe get into some of the rest of those later. But for now, one of the really important ones about not asking the state to do it for us. So Hal Draper was a key theorist of the free speech movement in Berkeley in the 60s and also a revolutionary socialist organizing at Berkeley at that time. And there's a really good article, which I would suggest that people search for online, called Free Speech and Political Struggle. I'll just read a quote from it. Here it is. So, of all the juridical weapons we cannot entrust to a state machine that is not ours, the worst is the right to be selective about democratic rights, because the state will make that weapon a double-edged one. And the sharp cutting edge will be used against the people, not against the fascists, in the long run, if not in the short. So, in other words, though it may seem to us that we can secure a temporary advantage by calling for far-right organizations to be banned, for their right to assemble or to speak to be taken away, by, say, proposing that hate speech laws be implemented, kind of like those that exist in some places in Europe, where it's illegal to publicly deny the existence of the Holocaust in some countries, for example. Though it may seem we can get a temporary advantage by calling for these things, in the long run, if not in the short run, that will also be turned against us. And there are many examples of this happening today. So, you know, in some states, in the name of defending free speech, there are some laws being passed, I think in Kentucky, this is the state legislature is trying to do this, that make heckling or interrupting a speaker or, you know, disagreeing publicly with a speaker a crime. Anarchists who, you know, wear a mask and confront people on the far right in, I believe, Alabama, there's a law that was originally created to try and go after the KKK that bans wearing a mask at a public demonstration. But, of course, that law is now being used against anarchists who wear masks to demonstrations. And, of course, you know, when people argue that on the left that there should be anti-hate crime legislation that pertains to speech, this can also be used against the left, against people of color defending themselves against racist attacks. We see so-called Blue Lives Matter laws being passed in some states that classify police as a special group that require protection against hate crimes and hate speech. Though there can be an appearance of advantage in some periods by calling on the state to restrict the democratic rights of forces in the far right, The abstract nature of formal right via the state, you know, means that that can very easily be turned against our side. That's not to say that there aren't some things we can do involving the state to combat the far right. So, for example, in the anti-fascist movement in Greece, you know, where the organization Golden Dawn has really, you know, got a significant percentage of the vote, some seats in parliament, and really, you know, become a big street fighting force. There, the Golden Dawn assassinated a left-wing singer a couple of years ago, a popular performing artist, and was brought up on criminal charges, you know, and the left has testified at the trial of Golden Dawn and used the trial to kind of expose the politics and intentions of the Golden Dawn organization. And so I would say, you know, there's a difference between bringing up the right on criminal charges for purposes of political exposure and saying that democratic rights ought to be restricted where we're not talking about criminal acts or creating new criminal statutes that would go after rights that the left also enjoys.
What about the tactic that some people have espoused about just ignoring the far right and therefore it'll go away? What do you think about that?
Ah, yes. So fascists mobilize because they want to meet and recruit people to their cause. And the economic and social conditions facing an immiserated middle class means that they'll succeed in this if they're not opposed. And if allowed to get more confident than they are now, they'll start openly physically attacking left-wing and labor organizations the way they did in the 1930s. And so people with liberal politics often say, you know, well, all press is good press when it comes to the far right, saying that protesting them only gives them the attention that they want. But not all press is good press, and not all attention is good attention. And so we have to be very patient in making this argument with people. One way to make the argument is to go through some of the best evidence we have, of course, comes from the first half of the 20th century, when large parts of the then very large socialist movement didn't understand fascism, and some decided to ignore it, hoping it would go away on its own. Others even argued that if fascists won power, it was a step towards an ultimate victory for the left, in the sense that the fascists would discredit themselves in office. And, of course, these tactics, as we know, proved tragic. But in some countries, like here in the U.S. and also in Britain, the left was able to confront and disorganize the fascists through mass protests that also pointed toward a left-wing alternative to fascism. And so we've got to go through that history. But why do we have to be very patient with people who aren't convinced that it's necessary to protest the fascists? Well, in part because it's definitely possible to protest them badly or wrongly in a way that can sometimes help the inner layer reach the outer layer and help the inner layer to grow. So convincing liberals that we have to protest the fascists is bound up with explaining and arguing for an effective strategy based on confronting them with a majority and isolating from their audience.
John, you've also written that the far right provides imaginary answers to real problems. And I confess I find this particularly frustrating on a daily basis. How do we respond to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So the right says that workers in the U.S. are unemployed and wages are low, and people who are in the middle class, you know, small business owners, are having difficulties with their profits and so on, because we're all in competition with immigrants for scarce jobs and resources, or perhaps in competition with people in inner cities who, you know, are on welfare and so on. But corporations have recovered from the crisis while wages have not risen. So there's more enough to go around if only we fight to increase our share of the pie, and that requires solidarity and not division. You know, and the right says that human beings are by nature racist and function best only when surrounded by people who speak, talk, and look like them. And we on the left have to show in practice the power of solidarity to show that this is not in fact the case. The right says the left doesn't care about white working class people. Certainly it seems like the Democratic Party doesn't. But we shouldn't follow the Democratic Party in this. The left has to show through its actions that it aims to help build a labor movement that lifts up and unites all workers everywhere. So, in short, everywhere that the official, you know, political institutions have failed to kind of project a left alternative to the far right's politics of division, the left has to succeed in not just kind of giving articulation to the existence of a left alternative, but showing that the working class movement is actually capable, and a strong left is capable of winning victories that makes people's that make people's lives better, and, you know, eventually solving the crisis that we've been living under since 2008. And, you know, once we begin to do that, then we'll be in a position to not just win, you know, battles against the far right week to week, but to begin to push back against their growth.
John, how do you answer when the far right says the left wants to take away their right to free speech?
Yes. The first thing I would say is, you know, I'm not for taking away anybody's legal rights. I think we'd all be better off with more rights and civil liberties, and I'm against increasing the state's power to restrict or censor speech and expression. And so, to people who are in the audience of the far right, in the outer layer, I'd say people need to understand that when someone protests someone else's speech or expresses public disagreement with it, whether in the form of, you know, a debate or a placard or even a group of people, you know, shouting or protesting, this itself is an exercise of the right to speak and assemble, which we both defend. So it's not necessarily a call to restrict rights. How can it be, since those very same rights protect this activity against state censorship? You know, and as one of my favorite authors once put it, between equal rights, force decides. And that force can be, you know, rhetorical force or moral force, but it can also be the force of numbers. And so to people in the far right, you know, and I confess I don't really care to talk to those people, but if I had to, I would say, you don't fool us. We know, whether or not you've yet understood this, that the society you hope to live in is one where there are no civil rights, where the state is free to censor speech and restrict the right to assemble, and where those institutions of real democracy within society, like trade unions and political organizations, have been liquidated and dissolved. So whether or not we're all in the streets now marching against fascists, most people know something about what fascists in power looked like in the 20th century, and most people are not going to let things go in that direction again. So to someone in the far right, if I had to talk to them, I'd say, the majority are against you, and we're going to do what it takes to stop you. So you'd better be ready to accept the social consequences of the content of your speech.
Do you think that under some circumstances we should prevent fascists from getting an audience, and in some cases we should actually shut them down?
I think there are cases where we should try and shut them down and perhaps, you know, run them out of town, but it's mainly when we have the numbers and the public support. So in other words, whenever we're in a situation where doing so will help increase or build on their already existing political isolation, which we've helped to create through a movement against fascism or the demonstration in question. So in general, I don't think we should be aiming to shut down people in the outer layers, except insofar as they take up the fascist tactics and ideas and move into the inner layers. We've got to have a debate with them and stage interventions that can pull them away from the inner layers. The point of saying this isn't to say that we should not protest garden variety Republicans. Of course, we have to protest them and their policies. For example, the attack on healthcare happening right now. The point is, just because Trump won the election doesn't mean that the entire Republican Party is now fascist and should be, you know, no platformed, or that we should call for their rights to be taken away. When we are talking about fascists, people who I would describe as being in the middle and inner layers, there's no formula for figuring out exactly how many people you have to have relative to them or how isolated they have to be to license running them out of town. It's even hard to specify in advance all the variables that would go into such a formula. So it's a matter of studying confrontations with the right, looking at some of the history, and getting some experience on the ground, keeping in mind that we're trying to isolate the outer from the inner layers and create a bridge to take people who are not really part of the onion at all and convince them to support the left. And so, you know, we've got to learn from our own experience and figure out how to make those judgments in practice. And because of that, it's very important for the movement to debate out tactics honestly and openly on a nationwide basis.
John, is that related to your statement that our tactics should depend on the balance of forces and the level of consciousness?
Absolutely. I'd said it's very difficult to specify in advance all the variables that would go into a kind of tactical calculation about when we should try and shut them down, when we should have a protest, when we should just debate. And there can't really be a formula, but we can generalize about the different kind of considerations we'll encounter. And so some considerations, and this is what I would describe as the balance of forces, are subjective or internal to our side. How many people do we have? How broad is our coalition? How representative of it is it of the community that the fascists are trying to intimidate? How much experience and confidence do we have, and how united is our coalition behind a common perspective? Other variables are objective or external to our side. How many members of a community not yet involved in our coalition, how do they perceive the fascists? How do they perceive our side? What divisions exist among the community outside of our coalition of anti-fascists, and how deep do those divisions run? And then, of course, we also have to take into account the subjective factors on the part of the fascists, how united and organized they are, how large their organizations are, how many people they can turn out to a demonstration. In general, the more considerations there are working against us, the more we tend to be talking about a patient fight for unity to build up our side's strength and size, which means, very importantly, a fight for ideas. The more considerations there are working for us, the more we can be talking about directly confronting the fascists, taking their public space, and demonstrating in action that they aren't welcome precisely because they're a minority and that the majority disagree with their ideas. Confrontation can sometimes help build our side's unity, strength, and size by showing that it's possible to fight, but whether and how that's the situation we're facing is a whole different tactical question unto itself.
John, talk about the importance of an emergency response network, please.
Yes. So in many cities since Trump's election, we've seen the formation of coalitions that draw up plans to use direct action tactics to prevent immigration officers, in ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from carrying out detention and deportation orders. So there's a whole discussion about the prospects for these organizations that we probably don't have time for today. But one thing to say about them, I think, is that they can probably play a role in fighting the far right in addition to fighting ICE and the state. So right now, they see their targets as the state and ICE. But I think we should argue that fascist marching in a neighborhood also constitutes an emergency worth responding to. It's not hard to imagine these emergency response networks, or ERNs, if they were strengthened and built to be larger, being the backbone of a kind of anti-fascist defense network or network of committees in cities that have something of a mass base, as many of the ERNs are already united front formations that bring together members of unions, members of church groups, people from many different walks of life.
John, we need to wrap up now, but I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind, to share just a bit about your background. You have such a remarkable clarity of thought on these topics, and we don't really know, that much about you.
Well, thank you. I'm a socialist activist here in Chicago, and I also I work for the publisher based in Chicago called Haymarket Books. I've been helping to organize on a college campus against the right, where we've confronted Melianopolis. There was also a threat that Gavin McInnes was going to bring the Proud Boys to campus. And so I've been organizing alongside a group of people that have been trying to figure out some of these tactical questions on the ground. And we've been debating with each other for some time the best way to do that. That's kind of where, we've been reading a lot of history and theory on these questions and trying to come up with a perspective that we think will be useful to people elsewhere in the country as well.
Well, that leads me to my next question. What kind of reading would you recommend for us and for our audience on these questions?
Sure. My co-presenter and I, Derek, gave a version of this presentation going through some of the stuff we're talking about here at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and that'll soon be available at a website called wearemany.org that has audio recordings of about a whole bunch of different things available. I write occasionally for a newspaper called Socialist Worker, which you can find at socialistworker.org. We're going to be featuring in-depth coverage of building the movement against the right in the years to come. If you'd like to talk to me more, I don't use Twitter, but you can feel free to search my name on Facebook. On the topic of fighting fascism, of course, we already mentioned Hal Draper's essay, Free Speech and Political Struggle, which has something to say about the questions about civil liberties that come up in this context. But, of course, I think on the topic of strategy against the right, it's hard to beat reading some of Leon Trotsky's writing in the 1930s on fighting fascism in Germany, France, and Spain. for people particularly interested in questions about civil liberties, I found an essay he wrote called Wither France to be extremely useful. I also think there's a ton to learn from how socialists fought fascism in Britain and the U.S. in the 1930s, and then again in Britain in the 1970s. One of the best things to read about Britain in the 1970s, about this group called the Anti-Nazi League, is a book by Dave Renton called When We Touch the Sky that we've used to help come up with some of the arguments that we're making here. In Socialist Worker, we've also been publishing some material on the history of an organization in the 1990s called the Midwest Network to Stop the Klan, that was founded by members of the socialist organization of which I'm also a part, the ISO, that might be of interest to some of your listeners. Thanks again for having me on the show.
John, thank you so much. You've been wonderful.
Every success to you, John, and to all of us. You take it easy, John Kerensky, and thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
All right, you two have a good one. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.